Dave?
I don't know. It's kind of funny. I'm like, the podium's here and the mic is over here. What's up, guys?
Hey. I'm Charlie Parker, alcoholic. Man, what a fine-looking crew. Well, that's fine. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Oh, boy. Let me turn this thing on. I set a timer to give the newcomers hope. Whew! I tell you, that fire is... it is on me. I mean, okay, boy, welcome. I'm really excited about this weekend. I've been hanging out with Bill for the last couple of days. Let me get some of the housekeeping out of the way, though. Charlie Parker, alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985, and for that I am truly grateful. And I do have 5 days more than Bill Cleveland. I'm not going to make a big deal out of it because I live in an abusive household where my wife has 5.5 months more than I do, and thinks it's a really big deal. When we get in an argument, sometimes she'll say, "Honey, just stick around for about 5.5 months. And it'll be much more clear to you, you know." But my home group is the primary purpose group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Austin, Texas, and we are a big book study group. We meet once a week on Tuesday nights at 7:30. If you're ever in Austin on a Tuesday night, come see us. We'd love to show you the same kind of hospitality you've been showing me since I got here. But we study the big book line by line, week after week, and it's just a lot more fun than it sounds like. You know, there was a time when I would have been like, oh boy, but it really is. We have about 225 people on a Tuesday night studying the big book in our little town. And just, it tells me that I think real alcoholics are hungry for a real solution. Bill picked me up at the airport yesterday. I've been hanging out with him and Zach, and then we picked up Ryan today. And Bill's a good friend, and him and Karen he just talked in Austin at our big citywide meeting, and he stayed at the house, and then so him and Karen and Katie, my wife is Katie, and she sends her regards, and I'm not worth a flip without her. I tell you, I didn't bring a tie. The last time we were not together, I took two left shoes from different pairs of shoes with me. That was interesting. There was a time when I wouldn't have been real fired up about a big book study meeting, and I'm going to talk about that tonight. It's real important for me to tell you that I'm not like, I didn't come over from Texas to straighten anybody out or, you know, not sent down from headquarters to tell you how you're killing people or anything, you know. That's always a real effective message, you know. Oh, so glad you dropped by, you know. I mean, had you not come by, we would have just continued killing people, you know. I am a big book guy. I call myself an unapologetic big book thumper, and the reason I say that is because I've been around AA for 28 years. I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous half my life, and I'm 57 years old, and I've done it a lot of different ways, and there's a lot of times where I've been a good example of a bad example, and I've worked this program by hanging around the fellowship, and I've worked it coming out of the big book, and my results have just been a lot better the time that I followed the clear-cut directions out of the book. And that's we're going to talk about that quite a bit this weekend. But tonight I'm just basically going to tell my story. But I want to thank anybody that had anything to do with putting this thing on. I mean, I know Jeff and Scott and Franklin and those guys. I mean, if you've been around if you've ever been involved in one of these deals, you know there's a lot of people that do a lot of work to get something like this to come together. And I want to thank them. And if it's anything like the groups at home, there's also a whole bunch of us that didn't do a darn thing. But we have some ideas about how it could have been done just a little bit better. You know? And that's the fellowship I crave. You know, I don't know. I just can't wait to hear what we're going to talk about this weekend. I like to start off. Get a little jumpy, you know. I mean, and I don't know who's jumpier, me or Bill, because we've been hanging out for 2 days, and for the last 2 days, every time I'd tell a story, they just seemed like they were going down and down. And at one point, he goes, "I'm really not sure this is a good idea." You know, we were really hoping for somebody a little more spiritual, and I was like, "I'm going to get spiritual any minute, I swear." But you know. The jokes just keep coming, you know. but I like to start off with a joke just to get warmed up, and because in AA we're talking, especially telling my story. I'm going to talk about my experience from my viewpoint. I hear people say, you know, that we're not going to give you any personal opinion. I'm going to be giving some opinions. You know, I mean, there's some stuff. I don't know how else to do it other than some of my opinions are going to show up. But we talk about coming out of our own experience. You know, it says, we're going to talk about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And you know, when I talk about coming out of my own experience, it always reminds me of this joke about this guy that's driving down a little farm road in Texas one day, and he sees a sign on this fence post, and it says, "Talking dog for sale." And he can't stand it. And he goes up to the farmhouse, and he says, "So you got a talking dog for sale?" Guy says, "Yeah, he's around back." And he wanders around back, and there's this red hound dog laying there by the porch. And he walks up to the dog, and he says, "So you can talk?" The dog says, "Well, I certainly can." And he goes, "How in the world did that happen?" And he goes, "Well, it's an interesting story." He says, "When I was young, I started picking up some speaking skills. And as I got older, I started developing some of the nuances of the language. I started picking up slang and local dialects and that sort of thing. It's made for a fascinating life." He said, "I had a 19-year career with the Drug Enforcement Administration, and I was able to infiltrate some situations that no human agent would have ever been able to get into. And I've eaten in some of the world's finest restaurants, cooking from the finest chefs. I've stayed in some of the best hotels in the world." He says, "But enough about me. The really interesting part, some of my pups have developed foreign language skills and have become international diplomats. And I have two pups that are in the United Nations right now. And it's just, all in all, it's been an amazing life." And the guy says, "God, it's just been fascinating talking to you." And he goes back up front where that farmer's sitting there, and he goes, "How much do you want for a dog like that?" And the guy goes, "I don't know, $40? And he goes, "Why would you ever sell a fascinating dog like that for $40? And the guy goes, "Oh, none of that crap he told you is true." So it's kind of like that around here. It doesn't really matter how good the story is if it's not my experience. But I'm going to put that where I reach. I swear, I've had a flamethrower at my ass before, but never quite like this. You know, somebody built a fine fire, I tell you. I get a merit badge for that. I don't know. Let's see. Let's get going. Let me see. I had a script. Okay, let's get drinking. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. I live in Austin, Texas now. It's 200 miles south of Dallas, but I grew up in Dallas, and I come from a pretty normal household. I mean, nobody was drinking. I come from a long line of Southern Baptists, you know, and I don't know what they were saying in that Baptist church, but what I was hearing was, "God loves you, but you're going to burn in hell." You know, it wasn't real encouraging. But but my mother was a school teacher. My father was a salesman. My mother taught first grade for 42 years. I was darn well prepared for the first grade. I mean, kind of kicked it pretty good, you know, all the way up to like fifth grade. But I grew up in a pretty normal household. I mean, I don't know exactly what normal is, but I've heard enough fifth steps over the years to know that a lot of people had it a lot worse than I did growing up. I mean, I came from a pretty functional household. I had a sister that was perfect, who's 5.5 years older than I am, and just all everything, you know, first chair flautist, drum majorette, National Honor Society, Delhi Symphony Orchestra. And then there's this kind of thuggish little brother. But, you know, my mother was a teacher, and education and intelligence was everything. And there was a lot of talk about IQ and potential. And I grew up, anybody else grew up under the burden of potential? Oh, my God. I mean, it was like, you know, why can't you live up to your potential? Why can't you be more like, you know, the kid across the street? And I remember thinking, you know, that's flattering, Mom, but I'm really not holding back that much, you know. I mean, you're kind of getting my best shot here, you know. But I will say that 12 years of heavy drinking and extensive use of outside issues will significantly lower people's expectations of you. You know, I mean, by the time I got here, it was like, just get a job. You know, I mean, forget about a career or a profession. Just get off the couch. And, you know, but I mean, I didn't start drinking. I think I drank at about 13. I got really drunk. I remember an episode that had a bottle of Cutty Sark involved at a motel in Waco. But I didn't really start drinking until I was 16. Ever since then, I mean, the first time I really got good and loaded, I remember thinking, oh, we're going to do this a lot. You know, and, I mean, something significant happened the first time I got loaded. And what I didn't know then was that from that date till I came into AA, drinking and getting loaded moved to the center of my life. And anything that interfered with that was going to get moved out of the way. I never said that out loud, but looking back, that was the deal. If anything got in between me and getting loaded, it was going to move out of the way. And this, you know, it's not everybody's story in AA. But it'd be real macho to stand up here and tell you that I drank a fifth of whiskey every day from that time till I sobered up. That wouldn't be true, but what it is true for me, I don't know, it's not everybody's in AA story, but for me, from the time I was 16 until the time I came into AA at the age of 28, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded one time under any circumstances for any reason. There was never one. A lot of people had it together a lot better than I did. I was all about getting loaded at every opportunity. There was never a time in my memory where, you know, somebody would pull something out and I'd go, oh, man, you know, it's my mom's birthday today or anything like that. The obsession was on and I would never turn it down. And I ran that way for a long time. I'm a big believer in AA's primary purpose and singleness of purpose. And I talk some about that. In an AA environment, I don't talk about outside issues. Sometimes I'll mention outside issues or additional issues or whatever the case may be. But, you know, the reason for that, and a lot of people, we didn't talk about singleness of purpose a lot when I was coming up in AA, you know, and I never really understood it. In fact, I came in when there was a big fight at this AA club in Austin, you know, and they were saying, you know, they won't let you talk about dope over at the Northland group. And we were all like, well, you know, dope's part of my story, you know, and I'll talk about whatever, you know, I want. And I never really thought about that there's some parts of my fifth step that were also part of my story that I didn't feel quite as compelled to talk about. But the whole thing behind it, nobody was talking about singleness of purpose, you know, and we'll talk about it some this weekend. I should tell you before I get too far into this deal that I got some pretty righteous ADD working up here, and there will be times in my talk when I'll say, we'll get back to that later. And what that means is that this is not the right time to introduce that chunk of information into the talk. But when I tell you we're going to get back to it later, we're probably not coming back, you know. I always get real excited when I actually circle back around to one, you know. I go off on little bunny trails and stuff, but you know, singleness of purpose, the short version of it is that AA is about alcoholics working with alcoholics. And it's, we're kind of a one-trick pony in AA. It's a pretty solid trick, but it's most effective when it's drunks working with drunks. And the thing I never really understood about that is the reason that is this identification that takes place when one drunk is talking to another one. And you know, you remember the first time you felt it. When I came into AA, the first time I'd been around people that understood why I get so loaded and knew why I get loaded, and they'd quit and they seemed happy about it. And there's an identification that takes place. And it's mentioned on page 18 in our book, where it says, it talks about how we got to be the only group of people that will go to a psychiatrist and pay them $200 an hour and lie to them the whole time. You know, I mean, if they say, "Do you drink?" I mean, I'm not going to go, "Yeah, I like to get a case of beer and a half gallon of vodka in the mornings and just see what the day brings after that." You know, I mean, I'm gonna say, you know, maybe a couple of beers if I'm mowing the yard or something. You know, like I've mowed the yard lately. You know, I mean, but. It goes on to say wives, parents, and intimate friends even find us more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. But here's where it gets interesting. It says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who's properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. And there's where the key line is right here. It says, until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So what did it say? It's saying until that understanding is reached, we're really not going anywhere. I mean, you know, there's something that happens. And it's like my wife and I are both, my wife's, I told you, she's got 29 years. I got 28. But we both are very fortunate. We get to go around to a lot of conferences and stuff. And one of my favorite little games that we play is, wherever we're going, they'll usually send somebody to come pick you up. And, you know, and you're talking to the guy, and, you know, and Scott says, "Hey, I'm going to come pick you up at the airport." And they'll always go, "I'm about five," and I go, Don't even tell me. Just be in baggage claim. It's a little thing I like to do. And it's this identification, you know, and I can't tell you how many times I've come down the escalator, and you come down into the baggage claim area, and you look around, and you go, "There's our boy right there." And you walk over there and go, "Are you Scott?" And he goes, yeah. "How'd you know?" And you're like, that identification is so important that out of all the 12-step programs that are out there, and there's a billion of them. I mean, there's Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters. I even heard there's a Lip Balm Addicts Anonymous, in case anybody's ever suffered from that heartbreaking malady. You know? But I swear, every time you say that, you see one guy with his Carmex going, "Oh, I feel you, buddy. I don't know. But out of all those 12-step programs, the only difference in any of them is the first half of the first step and the middle part of the 12-step. What I'm powerless over and who I carry the message to. You know, that identification is that important. So, you know, I sponsor a lot of guys, and hopefully you'll never hear any of them say in a meeting, "I'm an alcoholic and anything," because it doesn't matter. You know, saying that I'm an alcoholic and an addict would be like saying I'm an alcoholic and a contractor, or an alcoholic and a Texan, or whatever it is, because, you know, in that AA meeting, what we're identifying as is alcoholics. Just like if I go to a CA meeting, I would identify as a cocaine addict or something like that. And I never heard anybody breaking that down much for me. But for the bulk of the weekend, I will say the shortest version of my story, and I don't have enough time to talk a whole lot about my story. There's some really funny episodes that happened, and we were talking about some of them over at Bill's house last night, and I mean, some of that stuff's just funny, you know. I mean, but the shortest version of my story is that the guys that I drank with thought that I did way too much outside issues, and the guys that I used with were shocked by my drinking. You know, so, I mean, so everybody thought I was getting a little too loaded. You know, there wasn't anybody surprised when I wound up in AA. There wasn't anybody going, "Really? never even knew you had a problem. You know, I mean, you know, it's just like, oh, thank God. You know, I mean, listen to what those people say. You know, but I started using it about 16, and I really didn't need you guys until I was about 17, probably. It was pretty ragged, pretty fast. But there were some years, you know, the book, all this is, I'm going to be working out of this, and all this is here, my sponsor owns a book bindery. My sponsor's Myers R. in Dallas, and before he passed away, my sponsor was Mark Houston. But Myers just took a large print copy of the big book and took the stories out of the bag. But all this is a large print copy of the AA big book. I work a lot out of this book. This is one of my most prized possessions. And after hearing so much stuff in the discussion meetings for a while, it's nice to go back and reference some of this stuff. Because right there on the title page is the first promise in the big book. And I'd missed it for a long time. It says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And there was a time in my sobriety if somebody said they were a recovered alcoholic, I'd have been like, man, you better not say that. You know, I mean, it's like walking under a ladder or something. You know, you'll be drunk by sundown if you say you're recovered, you know. But what are we talking about having recovered from? And we'll talk about that a lot in the morning when we talk about the first step. But the way it rolled out for me was it worked really well for a while. The alcohol brought about a change in me that was really welcome. I've been needing a drink a long time before I ever got my hands on one. And from the moment I started doing it, it was like, I mean, I was all about it. And it started getting kind of sloppy. The book talks about how we start losing the power of choice and control. On page 24, it says something really interesting. It says, we pass into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of no avail. I always found that interesting, you know, that a desire to stop drinking will get me a front row seat in any AA meeting. But right there on page 24, it tells me it won't do a darn thing to keep me sober. It says, I pass into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. And it goes on to say that at certain times, I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. When I started off drinking, I mean, things were going good. I liked it. I was running with some guys that we were doing a lot of import-export business, and money was flowing, and, you know, we had the jet boats and cars and color TVs and motorcycles, and, you know, you couldn't tell me anything. And it started running a little sloppy, and I noticed that I got a little more loaded than most of those guys did, like one night, I was a blackout drinker. Any other blackout drinkers here tonight? I just thought you were supposed to, you know. I mean, I was drinking for oblivion every day, you know, and I blacked out several times a week. I was kind of proud of my driving. I mean, if you're blacking out three or four times a week and you only have a wreck every few months, I mean, I thought I was doing pretty good, you know. But there's a lot of crash sites that I can point out around Dallas, you know, where I hit that tree or I ran into a lady here. There's some more of those stories that are really funny, but we just don't have time to tell them. But one night I left this bar in a blackout in Dallas, and I should tell you that I was driving my mother's car. I was so poorly treated as a child that I ran away from home for good at the age of 28. I mean, I'm serious. Never went back. You know, but I left this bar in her car one night, and the way I came out of the blackout was there'd been a collision. And it was one of those nights where my field of vision was only about that big, and everything out here was real fuzzy, and I could see a fender sticking up in the air. But I'm rolling, and I keep my foot on the gas, and I go down the street, and I pull the car around the corner, and for some reason my shoes were over in the passenger floorboard. I didn't have my shoes on, and I reach over and I grab my shoes, and I go running back. I'm going to run back to the bar to report the car stolen, and And it's important to say this was not an extraordinary night. You know, this is just kind of me doing my deal the way. But I'm gonna run back and report the car stolen. And as I'm running back to the bar, I'm running under these trees with my shoes in my hand, and I look over there's two cops, and they got those big flashlights, and they're shining them down like this, and there's twinkling glass all in the street. And as I'm running along, I remember thinking, man, they got here fast, you know. So I go back and I report the car stolen. And the next morning, they said, Mr. Parker, you're going to have to take a polygraph test to pick your car up. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, it was involved in an accident before it was reported stolen. I said, you're kidding. And they said, no, they ran into a parked police car. And I remember thinking, that explains how they got here so fast, you know. Because I'd been really fuzzy on that one, you know. Norm Alpe used to talk about seconds and inches, about how our lives were saved and changed by seconds and inches. And I got dozens of stories like that where if those two cops had happened to have been standing there that night, you might have a different speaker up here tonight. But but it started going, you know, but I'd shake that off and I'd keep moving. Another thing, when I started losing the power of choice and control, I didn't really understand what was happening. A lot of this stuff I usually talk about when we're talking about step one, and we may cover some step one tonight, and then we can move a little further tomorrow. But the book spends the doctor's opinion. You know, our whole recovery program is in the first 103 pages of the book. Really, I mean, the doctor's opinion in the first 103 pages. The back chapters are very important, but they're like, you know, to wives, working with others. To wives, family afterwards, to employers, and a vision for you. So the bulk of our recovery program is in those first 103 pages in the doctor's opinion, and they spend almost half of that talking about step one. I think I'm going to save that for in the morning. This is a tightly run machine up here, you know. But I can't help but talk about it a little bit tonight because I didn't really realize what was going on. I didn't realize that I was losing the power of choice and control. And what happened? I was a big fan of pawn shops. Any other pawn shoppers here tonight? My people, you know, I loved everything about the pawn shops. I mean, because there was a purity of the equation that really appealed to me. I mean, you know, because now I didn't own, I should tell you up front before I forget to say it, that I didn't own very much stuff. So I was having to pawn stuff that didn't belong to me. And that adds a little heat to the equation. But, you know, we drunks make some brilliant plans. I mean, we'll make a plan, you know, that you could write it down and show it to somebody over at Pepperdine over here. And they look it over and go, that's a pretty solid plan, you know. And my plans worked right up till they quit working, you know. And the plan with the pawn shops was that you had 90 days to get everything back. And the thing I loved about pawn shops is there was no shame. I don't ever remember walking in a pawn shop and them going, good God, man, what are you going to do with this money, you know, or weren't you just in here this morning or something like that? You know, it was just give them the shotgun and they give you the money. And you give them the deer rifle and they give you the money. And I had 90 days to get everything out. And I could usually pull some kind of a scam or a deal or something during that 90 days to get it and keep that ball rolling. And like so many of my plans, it worked right up until it quit working. You know, and one night I did a deal one time that netted enough money to get everything out of the pawn shops. And but I stopped by the Spillway Pub there in Northeast Dallas. I'm just going to settle my tab. I'm not going to trigger the phenomenon of craving or anything, you know. I'm just going to go in and settle my tab. But I got a lot of ground to cover because I got to go to all these pawn shops. And I came out of a 5-day blackout. I didn't have many of those. I had a lot of those overnight blackouts where you're not sure what happened or where you were or where the car is and that sort of thing. But this was 5 days of I don't remember nothing. And well, there's some funny stories that came out of that one, but most of them involve outside issues. One little short one. This guy called me up. This guy called me up after that, and he goes, "Hey, I got some more of that Chinese outside issue," and I said, "I've never done any Chinese stuff." And he goes, "Oh, dude, you've done a lot of Chinese stuff." You know, and I was like, God didn't remember it, you know. But I come out of this blackout. And I had $8. I'm sitting on the edge of the bed at my mother's house, and I'll never forget it. I can tell you where I was sitting, which way I was facing, the temperature of the room. Because when I came out of that, I woke up and I had $8 in this pocket, and in this pocket I still had all those pawn tickets. I hadn't gotten a darn thing out of the pawn shop, and it was one of those mornings where you just go, "Oh no. Oh." Because I shot my wad on that deal I just did, and now I got nothing. And my dad was a good man. My dad worked hard for his stuff. There wasn't anybody giving him his stuff, and I'm out there pawning. And I wasn't a sociopath. I knew that was some bad BS, and I couldn't just let his deer rifle go to the pawnbroker for $40 or whatever it was. You know, so I'd have to go to my father and say, "Dad, listen. If we act now, I can get you a pretty good deal on all your stuff, you know. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail, you know." And the reason, I mean, I almost have to tell that. I should also tell you that I'm a big guy, ride Harleys, I'm a competitive shotgun shooter, I do a lot of other stuff. I'm liable to cry like a little girl in a pink dress up here at just about any moment. And one of the times is when I remember the desperation of those mornings, you know, but I almost have to tell that like it's a joke because what would happen next was that Dallas is a big spread out town like LA is. And it wasn't just we're going to go to the pawn shop. It's like we got to go over on Buckner Boulevard and get your deer rifle and your shotguns out on Beltline Road. And the metal detectors are out in Oak Cliff and your coin collection's in Garland. And we got to go, you know, to Harry Hines to pick up, you know, the sterling silver. And so it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. And when we'd be riding around, I'd be going, "Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again." And if I was lying to that man, I damn sure didn't know it, because it felt like I meant it with every fiber of my being that I will never do this again. What I didn't know, riding in the truck with my dad that day, is that I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. When I was promising him that I was never going to do that again, I might as well have promised him that I was going to flap my arms up here and fly around the room, because I did not have the power to never do that again. Within 24, 48, 72 hours, I'd hit the back door of my dad's house like a cat burglar, and it would just be like coming in there and just going, "That," and then off we go. And my father and I made the rounds of the pawn shop 3 times before I found my way to you people. That's how cool I was. That's how slick I was, is that I couldn't keep anything together, and I was a burden to anybody that was unfortunate enough to love or care about me. That's what I brought to you people. And about that time, I'd moved to Austin to go to school, and really completely driven by a student loan. I saw a piece of paper that said student loans reactivated, and I applied, and I got the money, and next thing you know, I'm a college student, you know, because it was go to work, student loan, take it. And so I'm down in Austin, and I started getting in a lot of trouble, but by this time, I'm starting to pick up charges, you know, and it's starting to look sloppy on paper, you know, and I'm picking up charges while I've got pending charges and that sort of thing. I picked up a forgery case and a 100-mile-an-hour DWI, but there was this maintenance guy in my apartments there was some people let me lay up in their apartment, and this guy kept coming in talking about treatment. The maintenance guy in these apartments, we'd be in there taking bong hits, getting ready for school, and like any good college student. And he kept talking about treatment. I don't know why he thought we wanted to hear anything about it. You know, he never talked about detox. He never talked about AA. He just talked about treatment. And I'll never forget, at one point he said, you might want to go pull a really good drunk before you go to treatment, because they're going to make you not want to drink anymore. And I remember thinking, I'm on it, you know. And that really good drunk took 9 months. For 9 months, I was fixing to go to treatment. That's a Texas term. I don't know if they say fixing out here, but it doesn't mean repairing. It means preparing. You know, that I was about to go to treatment for 9 months. And that whole time, you know, I mean, next week is a good time to go to treatment. You know, I mean, you know, and sometimes when things were really bad, by God, I'm going to go tomorrow. You know, I mean, probably tomorrow afternoon. But when tomorrow I'd get here, it was always today, and today was never the day, you know, until it was. Till that day when I couldn't go another day. And so I wound up checking myself into that treatment center he talked about. And I've got to move pretty fast, because I've had two very distinct experiences in AA. And I had my biggest spiritual awakening when I'd been sober 17 years. What happened in that first pass through the steps, I got a sponsor who I'll love till the day he dies. I mean, this guy was a huge part of my life, and he taught me a lot about character and discipline and foreign concepts like honesty and doing what you said you were going to do, if for no other reason than because you said you were going to do it. Is that kind of twisted? You know, I mean, he made me buy a pickup truck one time from a guy because I told the guy I was going to buy it. I found a better deal. But he's like, did you tell the guy you were going to come buy the truck? And I was like, you know, you can see it coming already, you know. And I'm like, technically, yes, you know. And he's like, well, then go buy the truck. I drove that truck with a resentment for a year and a half. But he wasn't a real step technician, you know. In fact, I like to say that, and we thought we were. We thought we were into the big book. My home group was a Tuesday night big book study meeting. I went to 3 Joe and Charlie big book studies, and but I missed an awful lot. Mark Houston used to like to say, how do you know what you don't know? And I missed a lot of stuff in those first pass through the steps. And I mean, I like to, but I'm a firm believer in sponsorship. And I always say, don't wait till you're perfect to do it. Because it's my firm belief that if the sponsor and the sponsee are both giving it their best shot, God takes up a lot of slack in that deal, you know, and both people were, you know, moved towards the solution. But we went through the steps, but the kind of the way we went through it was, are you alcoholic? And I said, yes. I mean, clearly I must be. If there is such a thing as an alcoholic, I must be one. I didn't know anybody that drank more than I did, so I'd been walking around saying I was alcoholic for a long time. Didn't really know what it meant, and we're going to talk about that some in the morning. But maybe. Oh. Yeah, we'll get back to that. But and do you believe in this power? Had a little struggle with the power, you know, and we had to talk about that a little bit because I'd had a lot of problems growing up in church and that sort of thing. I punched my dad. The book talks about some of us were violently anti-religious. I punched my father in the nose one Sunday morning over whether or not I was going to go to Sunday school that morning. I think that qualifies as violently anti-religious, you know. And my dad was about bill size, you know. It was a really ugly Sunday morning for me, but I didn't go to Sunday school and didn't for a long time after that. But, you know, do you believe in this power? And then we went right from... If you said, yeah, maybe, we went right from that to then let's get on our knees and do the third step prayer and get you right in inventory. And I wrote inventory. And, you know, and if you do that, and this is definitely what I like to talk about in a workshop. I love workshop environments because you really get a chance to go through what my second experience was with the steps. But I think what happens with a lot of us is we go right from are you willing to believe to the third step prayer. And if I do that, I skip this body of work that takes place in pages 60, 61, 62, and 63. And it's really not very important. We'll talk about it tomorrow. It's just the root of my problem and the basis of my recovery for the rest of my life. You know, other than that, skip it. You know, but so I wound up, I did that, and I'm writing the inventory, and so see if this sounds a little selfish. My take on the steps then was that I'm alcoholic and that's a problem. Can God help me? I hope so. Okay, three, let's do the third step prayer, and then we're going to write inventory. I'm going to talk about all the bad stuff that I've ever done, because then I won't feel as bad and I won't have to drink. And then I'll do a fifth step with somebody, and it's just going to be like a big, it was like a big confession kind of, and then I'll feel better. And then six and seven, you just kind of phone those in. And then eight and nine, go out and make amends so that I won't run into anybody that makes me feel bad, or I won't feel bad about, you know. And then 10 and 11, I knew to apologize if I really screwed up. And I would do some, but the bulk of my meditation was kind of keeping the 24-hour day book on the back of the toilet and, you know, reading and going, you know, might as well go, okay, God, see you tomorrow, you know. And then I was carrying that message, you know, to people. But I was very much about staying sober. I was very much an AA member. I was a fellowship making fool. I mean, I'm going to meetings all the time, and I'm dating AA girls and had AA roommates and going to AA barbecues and AA dances and that sort of thing. And I talk a lot about untreated alcoholism, and I hit a bottom at 4.5 years sober, and I hit a bottom, you know, blew up a marriage, had a child support check going out, and all these are things that are against my values. I didn't get married to get divorced, and you know, I really wanted to raise that little girl, and you know, things are starting to get ugly in sobriety. And then I waited the appropriate amount of time to get into another relationship. 14 days. And so 2.5 years later, I've blown up another marriage and got another child support check going on. And what happened for me, and by this time I got some things going on, and this is not a period of my life that I would have wanted videotaped and sent into the General Service Office on how a 7-year member of Alcoholics Anonymous would behave. But I was getting weary of the process, and I'm thinking, screw this. I've tried it your way. And I'm getting knocked to the mat every time I step in the ring. And I started kind of letting a little dishonesty creep in. You know, I started thinking, you know, half measures avail us nothing. I'm going to get mine, and I'm going to, you know, so it's nothing serious. It was just like a little wire fraud, a little income tax evasion, a little insurance, you know, and just the stuff that everybody does. And I loved it. My wife was sponsoring this lady that had a head-on collision. She was taking pills, and she called her up, and she was just as loaded as she can be. My wife let me hear the message, and the lady was like, Katie, this is... Katie called that girl's sponsor, and I'll never forget the lady. This is a story has nothing to do with anything, by the way. And she's telling her about it. She goes, she was loaded. And the woman goes, well, now we've all had our problems with pills. And you're like... No, we haven't. And, you know, I mean, but not for nothing. That has nothing to do with anything. But I thought of it when I said things everybody does. But what happened was, I met this woman that lived in New York City, and I got into a relationship that, let's just say, it was a little dishonest. You know, and the most dishonest thing about it was me. You know, I mean, she made a lot of money. Katie was my best friend for 20 years. Katie, I was at her wedding. We were like brother and sister for over 20 years until her husband passed away. And we've been a couple for 10 years. But during all this time, I mean, we were really like brother and sister. No flirtation, no innuendo, none of that stuff. Just buddies. And oh my gosh, she hated every relationship I was ever in. I mean, but she really didn't like this one. And you know, and at one point I remember her saying, Charlie, if this woman lives in Austin, I don't think you're dating her. And if she lived in Austin and made $30,000 a year, I guarantee you you're not dating her. And I remember thinking, well, she doesn't live in Austin, and she makes just one hell of a lot more than $30,000 a year. So what's your point, you know? And I'm in this dishonest relationship, but I mean, I'm kind of like I'm rocking along, and I'm very much about staying sober. And I mean, the idea of getting loaded horrifies me. I've had surgeries without anything. I had a liver biopsy with nothing but local. It freaked the doctor out. He was like, when he ran that thing in me, he goes, it's like a meat thermometer, and he ran it into the thing, and he goes, you mind if I ask what that felt like? And I was like, it was a lot like being stabbed, you know. But I was very much about being sober, and I'm going to the meetings, and I mean, let's just say there weren't a whole ton of people running up to me after the meeting saying, you know, could I get your phone number, or would you take me through the work? But I'm rocking along, and I would go up there, and I'd think, you know what, I'm going to get out of this marriage. I think I'm going to tell her this weekend when I get up there. But then you get up there and it's Thursday, you know, and there's no use, you know, blowing it on Thursday. I mean, and then next thing you know, you go, it's Saturday. I'm going home tomorrow, you know, and does it sound a little dishonest? You know, I mean, this went on for a total of 12 years. And 8 years into the marriage, 4 years dating and 8 years into the marriage. There's a lot of stuff going on. Well, we had a beach house out in the Hamptons that I had a key role in building. One time we're out there for the weekend, and I had company up from South Carolina, I decided we'd show these people Long Island from the air, and we're going to charter a plane, and we're going to fly from East Hampton Airport into LaGuardia and have a car pick us up and go to dinner. We're flying along, we take off, and we're flying along, and Long Island forks out by the Hamptons. The South Fork is the Hamptons, the North Fork, and in the middle is this Peconic Bay, and we're flying over that. We're just passing Shelter Island, and I'm in the co-pilot seat. It's a little six-seater Cessna 210 with retractable landing gear, and we're flying along, and yeah. And I'm in the co-pilot seat, and I put on the little headphones. And let me tell you, what you don't want to hear your charter pilot saying when you put the headphones on is, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, you know. And I'm going, and I'm looking at him, and they said, you're cleared to Gabretzky. And I look, and there's a runway at 10 o'clock, and we're not going to make it. We're not going to make land. We're not going to clear the trees. We're damn sure not going to make that runway. And he says, you don't understand. I've lost engine power. I can't make land. I'm going to have to ditch. And I remember thinking, what? I mean, I'm a gambler my whole life. I knew people that flew to the Hamptons every weekend for 20 years. And the first time I charter a plane, we're going to set it down at night in the drink. What are the odds of that? You know, he says, brace for impact. I'll never forget that. He says, he turns kind of towards shore, and he says, brace for impact. Anybody know how to do that? You know? And we come in, and boosh, we hit the water. And, I mean, it's just like Six Flags splash down times 1,000. There's water and spray and white and glass and noise. And then absolute silence. And all of a sudden I'm going, holy mackerel, I think we're okay. And I felt something on my knee. Now, this wasn't much of an airplane. Really crappy boat. You know, about the time I'm thinking, my God, I think we survived that landing. All of a sudden, I feel something that goes, and I can't get the door open. And I realize I got to get some air. And I go up to get some air, and there's nothing but water in the roof of that plane. And I remember thinking, so that's it. That's it. I die today in this blankety blank airplane. And I went back down, and the door came open. And I'd like to tell you that my first thought was of pulling my wife out, or my dog or the two people in the back. When I felt my feet come free, my first thought was, I'm out. I'm out. And I went up and I got some air and I came back down and I pulled my wife out. And I went back down and I got the dog out. And the other people went out the other side. And we were on CNN with Anderson Cooper, live from the headlines with Anderson Cooper and all this stuff. And the reason I tell this story is because we survived. Spoiler alert, I survived. But not by much. I came damn close to drowning. The reason I say that is because an event like that will make you start looking at things differently, you know? I started looking at what was going on in my life, you know, because I like to say that I was part of God's catch and release program, you know? I mean, I was at Crested Butte AA conference a couple of years ago, and I caught this big trout, giant trout, and then we look at it, we take a couple pictures, and we put it back in the water, and I always picture that trout going back down to his little trout buddies going, I saw the sun, you know? I was in the boat, you know? I can't help but think God's got a bigger plan for me, you know? I think I'm supposed to help other fishes, you know? But what happened is, as I come back to Austin, you know, and I'd started noticing some holes in my program. I'd started noticing how it took a keen eye, but and, you know, and I used to feel guilty about telling that story because it feels like I ought to get up here and tell you how I've been a shining example of AA principles since the day that I came in, and I used to feel bad about not being that guy till I found out I had so much company. You know, I mean, there's a lot of us that aren't quite nailing it, you know, and what happened was, I called up John Henry, this old timer in Austin, and I said, John Henry, man, I said, I'm so self-centered. I can't even be in a conversation with anybody. I mean, I have to just force myself to go, hey, Zach, how are the kids? And act like I give a flip about the answer, because I don't. All I care about is me and me and me. And it was all over me. I didn't realize it was mentioned in our book. But, I mean, the level of self-centeredness that I carried around as a 15-year sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous was unbelievable. I mean, I remember one time walking into the big AA club there in Austin, we had this card room, and we call it the half measures room. And we guys would play rummy in there, you know. And I walk in there one day, and this guy that I've known for a long time, he goes, hey, Charlie, what's up? And I go, hey. He goes, we need to go back out to Vegas sometime. And I go, yeah, we do. And I turn around, and I am horrified. Because I got zero memory of ever being in Vegas with this guy. And I'm 15 years sober, you know, and I start thinking about it. And I'm thinking about it, and I remember there was a trip to Vegas where four guys went out there, a bunch of AA guys, and we played golf and gambled and got massages and knocked around, you know, and all that. But the reason I didn't remember being in Vegas with this guy is because I wasn't in Vegas with this guy. I was in Vegas with me. And this guy just happened to be along for the ride. I'm sure I'm the only one that's that self-centered. It probably doesn't happen in California, but it's rampant in Texas, you know. And that's the level of self-centeredness I carry. I guarantee you that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow, because that's all I'm about, you know. I mean, my poor sponsees now must just be going, oh no. I got a sponsor that's only read three pages out of the big book, you know, because always, and we're going to, I'm not even going to tell you which three they are. We'll talk about it tomorrow. But, you know, what happened was I started getting into this work, and John Henry, I'll never forget it. He goes, meet me tomorrow. We'll go down to the ranch. It's a treatment center. He goes, I'm going to go talk to the winos. You know, and service work doesn't sound like a good idea, you know. I mean, especially when I'm that self-obsessed, I'm like, No, I was kind of hoping we'd meet somewhere and talk about the depth of my problems, you know. And I started working with these guys, I'm the 15, 16 year guy, you know. So they're asking me to sponsor them, and there were times where I could talk to you about life coach stuff, because I'd made so many brilliant choices in my life, but as far as taking a newcomer through the steps, you know, it had been a while, and there were times when I'd just be like, go read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, and I'd go read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. There were times where I felt like I was a step ahead of this guy, but I fell in with a crew of guys. One of my buddies had gone to treatment down at La Hacienda, and hooked up with a bunch of big book people down there, and our conversation started being about, you know, what do you do when they say this? What do you about when they say that? And about that time, so I'm starting to take an interest in the big book and how to have answers that are coming out of the book. And I started really getting excited about those conversations. And I'm seeing stuff that I'd never seen before. I'm seeing stuff in the book where I'm going, That's only in the fourth edition, right? I mean, I've never seen that, and that still happens to me. But I started doing this work, and about that time, a guy called me, and he goes, "Hey, I heard something about a big book study up in Dallas. Now we're in Austin," and I go, "You know, I'll check." And I called a couple of my guys up in Dallas, and they sent me this flyer, and it said Mark H. and this other guy are doing a big book weekend, you know. And I'm like, I told Katie, I said, you know, I don't think this is what Dick was looking for, but this guy is Chris's sponsor, and I like Chris. I've been listening to Chris a little bit, and so we wound up going, and my wife is like, what? You know, I mean, we wouldn't have been that excited about a big book meeting, much less a weekend, you know. Oh boy, let's talk about the big book, you know. And because she was 17 years sober at the time, and we go up there, and I meet this guy named Mark Houston, and I can almost never say his name without weeping because of the power of God spoke to me through this guy, Mark Houston. And, oh my God, I mean, we're sitting in this study, and I mean, there were times he's coming out, he's saying stuff. And I remember at one point leaning over to my wife and going, what book is this guy reading from? I mean, I have never heard any of the stuff he's talking about. And it just blew me away. And he wound up moving to Austin, and he became my sponsor and sponsored me from then until he died suddenly 3 years ago. But I tell you, in the time we worked together, my whole life changed. And I found out there was a group of people working this program at a level that I'd never experienced. I mean, you know, they were really into doing the work, you know, at a high level, and meeting regularly and talking about, you know, this program, and you know, having spiritual consent with each other, and having brothers that loved me enough to call me on stuff, whether it was going to hurt my feelings or not. And that was an established relationship where we said, "I'm giving you permission to call me on anything you see me doing, whether it hurts my feelings or not, you know." And because otherwise we get into what we call these unsigned death pacts with each other, where it's like, look, you don't call me on my deal, I won't call you on your stuff. Nod your head if you understand, you know, and we'd move forward like that. Well, this was, and it was all done under the path of consideration and with love and concern for each other. We weren't just breaking each other's chops all the time, but I mean, it would say stuff like, you know, is it possible that, or I'd like to offer for your consideration that maybe, you know, because otherwise you're going to hear my ego defending itself and telling you why you got the story wrong. And if you let me tell the story, I'll never forget the first time. I'm all over the place, but I'll be done here in a minute. At that workshop, at one point, Mark brings this guy up, and I think his name was Paul. And Paul come up here, and he's this little guy Mark had been kind of picking on the whole weekend, in a kind of way. And he gets him up there, and he goes, "Paul, let me ask you something." He goes, "This is just an example of the kind of work Mark did. He had a lot of clarity, and he was very direct." And he gets this guy, he goes, "Paul, do you meditate?" And Paul goes, "Well, I'm a truck driver, see? And a lot of times when I'm driving the truck, I'll meditate, you know? And Mark goes, I'll never forget it. Mark goes, okay, Paul, two things. He goes, first of all, when you're driving the truck, we very much want you to be about driving the truck. You know, I mean, we really don't need you hurtling down the road in a tractor trailer rig meditating. And he goes, second of all, in the future, when I ask you a yes or no question, man, I love that guy. He says, in the future, when I ask you a yes or no question, I'm going to expect a yes or no response. So I'm going to ask you again if you meditate, and it's very important to me for you to say no. And I remember sitting there going, "Woo! Man, am I glad he didn't call me up there." Because Mark used to say you could ask an alcoholic if they're married and you get a 5-minute answer. You know, I mean, it's like that was a yes or no question, you know. But we started doing this work at a whole nother level. And I mean, and I started having a meeting at my house on Thursday nights, and it was Mark and me and all my sponsees. And it's the best AA I've ever been involved in. We were meeting every week, and we're talking about the amends process and writing amends cards and going out and making all of our amends. And some of mine were 25 years old or 20 years old, you know, and that's the stuff I want to talk about this weekend. But it just turned out that there was a level of the game going on I didn't even know about. I mean, I'm an NFL football fan. I assume we're all Dallas Cowboy fans here. I've been a I love saying that. I said that in Philadelphia the other day, and I was like, so much for the city of brotherly love. But I've been a Cowboy fan since they were good, you know, and I'm sponsoring this guy one time. And he says, you know, my family's got a skybox at Texas Stadium. And I'm like, yeah, good for you, you know. And a few months later, he calls me up one day and he goes, hey, man, you want to go to the see the Eagles game Monday night and sit in our skybox? And I said, yes, I do. And I go to his grandfather's house, and we get in the car, and we go down to Texas Stadium. Now, I've had season tickets before, and, you know, so we go to a special little parking lot. We go in through a special little gate. We go up a quiet little escalator into this little quiet hallway, and we go down to the skybox, and the field is right there, and there's little waiters bringing in cookies and ice, and I'm looking around. I don't know whether to be excited about being in a skybox or to be pissed off about having sat in the cheap seats for 20 years. But that was exactly my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. If I almost missed it, if I had died in that car wreck, in that plane crash, if I had died, if you'd have come to me when I had 17 years of sobriety and said, Charlie, what is going to change your life and set you on fire is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous coming right out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you, you're crazy, man, because I've been in AA for 17 years. I know what AA has to offer me, and I had never stuck a toe in the water. Just like those football games, it turned out there was people doing this deal at a level that I had never experienced before. I have just been on fire with AA for the last 10 years, and a little over, and I live in an AA household. My wife is a very active AA member. She sponsors a ton of people. She's the best at hearing inventory of anybody I've ever seen, and we're going to talk about that some when we talk about the inventory process, because there was a time when that wouldn't have made any sense to me. You know, how could one person be better at hearing inventory than any? It's like saying that somebody's really good at listening to a CD or something, you know. But now it makes a lot of sense to me. And that's the kind of stuff we talk about. I am so grateful to have gotten, well, first of all, that I didn't die in that plane crash 10 years ago, but the level of life that I've been experiencing since then is so far and away beyond anything that I'd ever experienced. I can't even tell you about it. I get emotional when I see the clear and obvious hand of God moving in my life. And looking back on one time, we were talking to Mark one day, and he goes, "Do you really think you had anything to do with being at that Big Book workshop that weekend?" I mean, looking back on it, I can see where God just moved us into a direction of being right where he wanted us to be, where we could be of maximum service. There's a quote on page 100 that I like to close with. It says, "Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned." I had been reading this and closing talks with it for a long time before I ever saw that line that says, "When we look back." Because, you know, God's will, am I the only one that God's will looks like it's going to be kind of a ripoff? You know? I mean, it looks like a jip on the front end. You know? I mean, really? Mailed that much money to the IRS? You know? Or something? But it says, when we look back, we see that the things that came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Because I can't see it on the front end. Excuse me. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I'm really looking forward to this weekend. I love AA, I love drunks, and I love talking about this stuff. I thank God for bringing me back to AA, and I thank AA for bringing me back to my relationship with God. Thanks for listening to me, guys.